ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. If you listened to last week's episode, I had mentioned doing a discussion of the many incarnations of Ben-Hur for this week's podcast. Rick Aragon and I recorded a fantastic 60-minute episode, but apparently the Charlton Heston gods didn't like what I said about him, and the episode vanished. It is gone into the internet ether. So Rick and I are in the process of re-recording that episode, but I didn't want to leave you listeners with nothing this week, so you're essentially getting a first look. What was originally planned for the next episode is now this episode. First, we're going to start with an interview with Peter Winkler, author of Real James Dean, Intimate Memories from Those Who Knew Him. Now, if you're a James Dean fan, Winkler's text is amazing because he distills a plethora of written and verbal correspondence from people who had written about James Dean, talked about James Dean. It's essentially a compendium of all this amazing written information and interviews, correspondence, what have you, from people who knew James Dean. So you're getting both the positive, the negative, the contradictory. It's an invaluable resource for those fans of James Dean's legacy. So let's give Peter Winkler a listen.
I was so excited that you agreed to an interview because there's so many James Dean books and articles out there that this one is a great package of information that I was not privy to. So I was very happy to get to talk to you about it today.
Oh, well, thank you for your kind compliments on the book.
What's your own history, you know, with James Dean as an actor, as a personality? How did you come to discover him yourself?
When I was college, way back eons ago, when the earth was hopping young, this was about 1976 or 7. Now, I had, previous to that, I had actually once sat down and stayed inside on a summer afternoon, rather than going out and swimming in the pool, to watch Rebel Without a Cause on one of the local L.A. stations, because I got the impression from something I read, maybe it was Leonard Maltin's TV movie guide, that it was a classic and very important, and of course, I was into everything film then. So I watched it, and it didn't really do anything for me, or I didn't really respond at that point in my life. But a couple of years later, William Bast, James Dean's college roommate and friend who wrote the first biography of him, produced and wrote a TV movie called James Dean, starring Stephen McCatty.
I've seen that one. That's actually, I would say, one of the better biopics about Dean that's out there.
Yeah. Well, McCatty's performance is very good. I was very taken with it, and I was kind of touched by it. I thought it was kind of poignant, and that at that point suddenly I became interested in James Dean. And fortunately, this was the period of time in the mid 1970s when it was the first resurgence of interest in Dean, about 20 years after he had died. And there were several biographies and books that had been published. There was a documentary that came out, James Dean, the First American Teenager. So of course, I got all of the books one by one, and I read them, and for a while I would say I was nearly obsessed with James Dean, and my interest continued. It didn't stay at that high a level, but I remained interested in James Dean. When a new book would come out, I would, of course, look at it. I was interested to see what, if anything, the author had discovered that might be new, or just what their take on Dean's life and career was. At some point, having read almost all of the James Dean books printed in the English language, I thought that some of them quoted a line or two, a sentence or two, from some of these articles that had been printed in Modern Screen or Photoplay back in the mid-50s, and then subsequently some of the people who knew Dean, who were his co-stars or colleagues, wrote autobiographies and devoted space to him. So I thought, what about putting all of those articles, all of those portions of those autobiographies together in one collection, but not cut or edited or used just a bit here or a bit there, but complete, and that's how the idea for the book was born.
I love that it's a compendium. You have contradicting opinions, and you have all the... It's definitely a world. Not necessarily... I hate to use the term cult, but it's the cult of Dean, almost, in terms of showing all the different perspectives. And I was fortunate to talk to Jane Withers a couple years ago, and she has her amazing James Dean story, which she had to tell me, which I was so great to hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak. What's the research process like with something like that? Is it just as simple as going into all the fan magazines or all these biographies and just listing out the interviews? Or what was it like to actually distill all of this material? Because I'm sure it was countless, you know, endless reams of writings and interviews about him.
Well, most of the articles that were in the movie fan magazine, some during his... Some when he was alive, but he only made his three films in a rather small period of time, 18 months. There weren't that many articles printed about him, about a dozen when he was alive. But after he died, of course, there was like a flood of articles, about 150 or 140 in a 2 or 3 year period of time. Most of the important articles were referenced in the bibliographies of the existing James Dean books. So the article that George Stevens wrote recalling him, or the article Natalie Wood wrote, or wrote with a studio publicist possibly. All of these things were known about, but like I said, they were only bits and pieces had been used before. So I kind of put together my own bibliography, if you will, of all of the articles and of all the showbiz memoirs like director Elia Kazan's or Raymond Massey's. And then I started to acquire the magazines. eBay was really my main source. It's amazing, but fortunately, some people kept these magazines in the attic or somewhere for a long, long time, but they were intact, and I was able to purchase them. And some of the other material, I simply got the books, actually, rather than buying them all. I got them from the library and photocopied the pages where the author had written about their recollections of Dean. And there were some other material that interviews with some of these people, which I was aware of, and some of it I located using the Internet. And then the last resource, which was actually important, is the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which puts on the yearly Oscar telecast, has
right.
a library, the Margaret Herrick Library in Beverly Hills, California, which I'm fortunate enough to live very nearby. So I went there, and they have, which is really quite amazing, in addition to just about every book you can think of and back issues of magazines relating to movies, television, they also have files which they keep on actors, writers, directors, where I don't know who does this probably on a daily or weekly basis, but they clip out stories that they find in the Hollywood trade papers or in general interest magazines, and they put a copy into the file. Some point when the person either dies or they've been around a long time, if they're still alive, they transfer a lot of this material, which gets fragile with age, to microfiche cards, which they then have accessible on a microfiche reader, and you can even print out from it. So I've been there a number of times over the years, and I was able to get some material also that way.
In looking through all of this information, and again, there's been so much written about him, was there any kind of new discovery for you, anything that made you say, you know, hey, people don't necessarily know this, or this is just something that either you didn't know? Was there any kind of big wow moment in all your research?
Well, I think the two chapters written by John Gilmore, who knew Dean, which come from his memoir, are going to have... His whole memoir is really quite revealing and rather lurid, but fascinating. It's very compelling to read, as he has had encounters over the years with lots of iconic personalities in the popular culture. I think that his two chapters are very revealing because they have a kind of gritty, realistic quality to them. And they're certainly not for the faint of heart, because he gets into aspects of Dean's personality that wasn't always so wonderful and charming. And he also talks about Dean's dark side, and he also discusses, quite frankly, Dean's bisexuality. He said that they experimented with each other at least on one or two occasions, or Dean wanted to have a sexual encounter with him. And so that, I think, is probably some of the material that is going to surprise people. I also think that the excerpt from Tony Lee Scott's memoir is going to be very unusual because it shows that at the same time Dean could be unusually sensitive as he was to Tony Lee Scott. She told me when I spoke to her about using the material that she was so devastated by having to lose her leg at a young age after a motorcycle accident. And Dean really was able to restore her confidence and her faith in herself. And so he really was a lifesaver to her.
By that same token, what do you think? I mean, I know there's a lot of discussion about, you know, James Dean as kind of the harbinger of method acting and what that, how that's transformed in the cinema of today. But what do you think is, out of all of the information out there about Dean, the greatest misconception about him?
Well, I think actually one of the misconceptions is James Dean, Montgomery Clift, chronologically, Marlon Brando, and then James Dean are actually considered the holy trinity of the actor studio and the school of method acting, which is a series of, or a set of techniques that derives from the Russian acting teacher Stanislavski. But the fact is that's interesting is that actually neither, none of the three really spent that much time or did much work at the actor studio. Marlon Brando actually was taught by Stella Adler and spent some time at the New School in New York. James Dean did become a member of the actor studio, but the first time he performed an individual scene before the rest of the students and Lee Strasberg, who was the head of the studio, Strasberg criticized it so severely that Dean was devastated and I guess somewhat humiliated. He vowed that he was never going to come back again. He did periodically hang around, and he had a kind of, one of his cultural mentors who wrote about him, and I have it in the book, was Frank Corsaro, who was an actor, became a director, became quite noted as actually a director of operas and also a librettist. He kind of became an influence on Dean culturally because Dean come off the farm and was rather naive about a lot of things, but he had a great curiosity and a great willingness to learn, and he learned a lot of things about music and art from Corsaro. But I think that it's a mistake to place Dean as a representative of the actor studio. Corsaro and also Elia Kazan both agreed that Dean was a instinctual actor. He really, both of them say, did not really have much technique, so he would either get a scene the first time or the first couple of times they tried when he was shooting his films, or he wouldn't get it at all. So I don't really think he learned that much about stage technique and acting at the actor studio, but because he is because of his films and he became an icon, he's associated with the studio, and I think part of that has to do with the actor studio wanting to really, it's good marketing for them. I mean, you want these charismatic actors, also Marilyn Monroe, I would add to the three. You want these tremendously charismatic actors who are stars and icons to represent you. Why wouldn't you? It's going to bring in acting students.
You bring up Marilyn Monroe, and James Dean and her are kind of the poster children for the tragic side of Hollywood. In looking at your book, there's both pros and cons to him as a person, and it presents him as a personality as opposed to just kind of this amorphous symbol. How do you look at James Dean's legacy all these decades after his death?
I think that his legacy is that, well, first of all, it's interesting about the various ways he's portrayed in the various pieces in the book. The fact is that how you felt about James Dean, obviously the people who knew him and met him when he was alive, and there were people who loved him, there were people who adored him, and there were people who detested him. How you saw him, I think, depends on, I guess, what face he showed you at on any given day or at any one time. He was a very changeable guy. Bill Bast told me that if you ask six people who knew Jimmy to tell you about him, you will hear about six different Jimmy Deans. But as for his lasting legacy on film, I think that, first of all, he remains an immensely attractive screen personality, and his performances are as vivid and really mesmerizing as when they were first done. His characters in East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause, I think, have a relatability to young people, teenagers especially, and young people, and even adults. They reach you at a certain level that, let's say, the performance of some other actors or stars from the Golden Age don't really reach you. They have something to say to people even all these decades after he died. So I really think that is his legacy more than being the king of cool, as some people, or an icon of cool, or an icon of rebellion. I don't think he was engaged in any rebellion, either on a personal level, and I don't really think that he was trying to craft, because he didn't write these films and direct them, and I don't think he was that advanced in terms of thinking about his image at that point or having the ability to craft it. So I don't really think the films are putting any type of message out as toward a rebellion against any part of or aspect of society, even though the title, of course, of Rebel Without a Cause has rebel in it, but actually that's a good title, but they used it because it came from a book that had been written in the 1950s, a social psychologist that was all about a young guy who was a sort of a petty criminal who was in prison. And that's why Rebel Without a Cause, because why did this guy who was the criminal do all these antisocial things? That was what the psychologist was trying to find out. But they kept the title because it's a very marketable title. It sounds good. But the Jim Stark character in the movie is, I don't think he's rebelling against anything in particular, unless it's, I guess, a sort of maybe his parent flawed values.
Most think Nicholas, it's almost ironic in the scheme of the movie, because it's the story of three kids trying to make nuclear family almost, which seems to be the apotheosis of, you know, all American, very conservative 1950s values. They're not Marlon Brando in The Wild One. We've seen a lot of other actors in the modern era play Dean. You mentioned Stephen McCaddy in the 70s version, which I think is probably one of the better ones. Have you seen any of the other Dean biopics?
I've seen them all, I think.
Have we hit on a Dean yet, other than Stephen McCaddy, in your opinion?
I think that of the ones that have been made, and I, by the way, include Life. That's the title of the film that was made a couple of years ago with Robert Pattinson and Dane DeHaan, which is about the time that the 2 weeks, or in the movie says it's about a month, that the Dennis Stock, the photographer, who was played by Pattinson, spent with Dean, who was played by Dane DeHaan. I have to say, unfortunately, that's one of the worst ones. I think the problem is that I don't think that any of them has been particularly good. Some are worse than others. Some of that has to do with who's playing Dean. I think Stephen McCaddy is probably gave the best performance as Dean of the various actors, and I include the James Franco made-for-TV movie. The problem is that, first of all, some of them were made, like the Bill Bast-produced James Dean, which I think is maybe on balance might be the best one, because of Bast's participation. Some of the earlier ones suffered from the fact that you could not get very explicit with certain subjects in a TV movie. In fact, the Bill Bast one makes a couple of indirect references to Dean's bisexuality and Bast's own sexuality, but it doesn't get explicit, it can't. And there also are certain people who are, they're not named by their real name, but they are obviously played by, you know, actors with a different name, and they're sort of stand-ins for certain people in his life. And I think the problem with all of these biopics where some actor is or actress is playing someone like Dean or Marilyn Monroe, it could be anybody, is you have a character, you have a person like James Dean who is inimitable. Nobody has ever been able to really reproduce Dean's impact and the quality of his performances. He just can't be really imitated, or he can't be recreated with the same level of intensity. And then you ask some actor, who may be a fairly good actor, be just like James Dean. And it's just not possible. And then, of course, you have the second problem, which is, in most cases, the writers and directors of these films, whether they be theatrical, some of them were intended to be theatrical but ended up going to video, they're not very good. I don't know why. For instance, the James Franco one I thought was terribly written because facts about James Dean's life are very well known, but the writer was fudging certain things, substituting certain things that he made up for certain real incidents, and the real incident is, first of all, factual, and it was more interesting than what he came up with to substitute it. I really don't know why that happened, but the actor who came closest to embodying the essence of James Dean without playing James Dean, playing the character James Dean in a biopic, was an actor named Christopher Jones, who had a very abbreviated career in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
The last question I have is, I know you mentioned seeing Rebel Without a Cause and it didn't really affect you the first time that you saw it, but with all this research and obviously seeing the three films that he's made, do you have a favorite of the James Dean trio?
Yes, Rebel Without a Cause is my favorite. It's always been my favorite. There's a certain aspect of East of Eden and Giant that is like their period, that marked them as somewhat period melodramas or period pieces. And Rebel Without a Cause seems more contemporary. I also think that the situation with the three characters and seems more valid on a dramatic level and also more relatable to people than the individual situations of Dean's characters in Eden or Giant. Not that I don't like them, obviously. I love his performances in all of them. And Rebel Without a Cause was the most fully realized of Dean's performances because Nicholas Ray gave him a lot of leeway to develop his performance and incorporate all sorts of things into his characterization. And also I think Ray's direction is the best of all three films, especially visually. He had the best film sense. It's a very parts of it are very beautiful visually.
To throw this out real quick before we close it up, when I was talking to a writer about Marilyn Monroe, I asked, you know, to play armchair prophecier for a second, and, you know, that transition from the 50s into the 60s for a lot of actors was very, not necessarily difficult, just different because the films were, the way of filmmaking was different. If James Dean had, you know, miraculously gone on to make films into the 60s, do you think that audiences would he have had to stay the characters that he had played before? Do you think he would have been able to adapt into the new decade?
I think the James Dean acting capability had not yet been nearly fully tapped in the three films he made. I think that he would have continued to give very remarkable, or at least in many cases, interesting performances in a variety of roles. He also said he wanted to direct and even maybe eventually write films. I think his career would have been quite similar to some of his contemporaries like Brando or maybe Steve McQueen or Paul Newman. He would have done a variety of films. He might have directed one or two. And, of course, many of those films might have been mediocre, or sometimes you make a misfire, and sometimes you make an outright dud or two. But I'm sure there would have been some very good, very memorable performances there that would have emerged. So I don't think he would have had a problem with continuing his career as it had begun.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciated speaking with you. It was a great pleasure.
Next, we'll be hearing from Scott Tracy Griffin, author of the wonderful Tarzan on Film, newly released from Titan Books. If you're a fan of the Ape Man, or you just want to learn about the decades of celluloid that feature Edgar Rice Burroughs' character, you're going to want to pick this up. Griffin sat down to talk to me, and it's here for your listening pleasure, so let's give it a listen.
I love books like yours because I'm a history nut, so I love getting as much a history on a topic in one go as I can. And looking through the book and reading about, you know, a subject that I knew of, but I didn't know the intricacies of it. I love the book so much.
Oh, thank you.
I guess to start, it's got a great history there. What was your interest in Tarzan?
Well, I grew up in rural Mississippi on a cattle ranch, and we had cows and all kinds of animals. And I guess it was just sort of cultural osmosis. I don't know how I knew who Tarzan was, but I knew there was this guy that ran around with apes and lions and elephants, and that was very fascinating to me. And I discovered the books by Edgar Rice Burroughs when I was 9 years old. So my interest came through the books and reading the novels of Edgar Rice Burroughs, and then everything else followed, the comic books, the movies, and everything else. And, Burroughs' writing just drew me in. I felt like he was a fascinating, amazing storyteller, and that he just created this really compelling character, and I wanted to know more about it.
And I guess from there, what was the impetus for actually taking all that and writing a book on it?
Well, I moved to Los Angeles from Mississippi in 1989, and I had always wanted to write and work in the film industry. And so I started tracking down some of the old film Tarzans and talking to them, interviewing them, getting their histories. I started writing for the movie magazines like Cine Fantastique and Femme Fatale. And so pretty soon I started getting enough material for a book, and it was just a matter of finding the right publisher and the right time. I just felt like the topic was ripe for a new book with lots of color, and one thing I wanted to do was sort of highlight the actors and actresses who played the roles.
And what was the research process, I guess, in putting all of this together? I'm assuming it was more than just going on to IMDb and looking at, you know, the basic information that was out.
Well, I had interviewed a lot of these actors and actresses over the past 20 years or so, and you'll see in my acknowledgments a list of all the ones I've talked to over the years. And so I had their firsthand stories. I also had, I've been featured in various documentaries and everything. So it was an ongoing 20-year research project. And then once Titan Books, my publisher, asked me to do the book, we had about a 2-year span before we were ready to release it because of the new Tarzan movie. So that was gave me time to go back and reread all the old reviews. The Margaret Herrick Motion Picture Library was an important resource. The Los Angeles Times database at the Los Angeles Public Library was another resource. Plus, I have scores of old movie magazines, you know, from the old days up to modern days. So I have a tremendous library of resources. And it was just a matter of pulling all that together and telling the story in a very concise, succinct format. As you can tell, I had a lot to fit 52 films and 7 TV series into 224 pages.
That was surprising to me because I think most audiences, you know, who know just kind of the bare bones, if they didn't know of the movie that just came out, you know, a few months ago, it's pretty much relegated to the Weissmuller films. For me, going back and looking at just how far I knew the text, the Burroughs novels, but seeing just how quickly after they were making films, that was just amazing to me because I had no idea that Tarzan was kind of a consistent presence in popular culture for a rather long time.
For the first 50 years, there was a Tarzan movie on average every 14 months. They were just about yearly. I think 6 years was the longest gap between films, 1921 to 1927. Burroughs, the writer, the author, always felt like the Tarzan movie back in those days should be like the circus, something that comes to town every year.
For people that don't know, the uninitiated, why, I think, again, going back to those Weissmuller films, you know, do you kind of have, it's very intriguing to me that we saw that resurgence specifically, you know, around the World War II into the 30s and 40s into the 50s. Why do you, I guess, believe that resurgence is the one that's, I think, the most prominent? Is it just because Johnny Weissmuller was so perfectly suited to the role, or was there something deeper there?
Well, I think it was a perfect storm of things. First of all, I think Edgar Rice Burroughs was a creative genius, and in creating Tarzan, he just tapped into sort of a universal primal myth of our beginnings and who we are and who we want to be. So I think there was that the character was an amazing, fascinating, compelling character. Of course, the movie studios had their own storylines. They used the character in their own stories. They didn't adapt the novels. Also, I think it was the fact that MGM was the biggest and grandest studio in the world, and they did 6 big budget pictures. So this picture got the best resources at its disposal, and this has happened throughout the past few years. You know, the Disney film of the 1990s, the best technology and the best craftsmen we had at the time devoted themselves to Tarzan and to creating a Tarzan film. This new movie that was rumored to have a $180 million budget. Greystoke, at the time, had the top technology and the top artisans and craftsmen working on it. The story is just something that is so compelling that it brings all these elements together. Top craftspeople, of course, over the history of the novels, the artists, some of the top artists like Frank Frazetta, Hal Foster, Bern Hogarth, have illustrated the stories. And it was just sort of a perfect storm of the right time and the right place. Of course, in the Depression era, people were escaping into the movies, and Tarzan provided great escapist entertainment.
The Burroughs novels, there's been, especially in light of the 2016 film that just came out, you know, a lot of people said it's a colonialist piece of literature, the Burroughs novels are racist, and there's all these horrific concepts coming up in articles, but yet Hollywood still really wants to keep the Tarzan franchise going. Why do you think that legacy continues to endure?
Well, I think the objections come more from the idea of Tarzan, of this white man running around Africa, lording over everything, than the actual, you know, there are certainly objectionable passages in books that are more than 100 years old, but I never felt like Burroughs personally was a racist, and in many ways Tarzan was anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist. You know, the bad guys were the ones who were coming in to despoil the jungle. So I think, you know, as a character, as a moral character, Tarzan is just this paragon of morality, because it was Burroughs' sort of thought experiment of what we would do if we weren't corrupted by civilization. He felt like civilization is what makes us into being deceitful and dishonest and everything, and that if we were just raised in a pure environment, that we would sort of shed this original sin and go back to our roots and be these honorable, noble creatures. So I think there's a lot of pith there that the critics don't really know, that they're just objecting to an idea. I think a lot of the artists, the creators, the directors, producers, actors, writers, they get it. You know, they've delved into this and they see the potential there, that this is just a tremendous myth that really doesn't, is timeless and doesn't have to die away, that the myth can be reinterpreted over and over again for the times.
I like what you said about he's very much a moral figure, and I wrote an article comparing Tarzan with Jungle Book and Pete's Dragon that just came out, in terms of, you know, the feral man of the jungle and how Hollywood seems to be really interested in that this summer more than I've seen of late. And it really is kind of that return to nature and finding our best selves when we go back to the beginning and all of that. So I feel like I wasn't completely talking out of my hat there.
Yes, I think you hit the mark on right on the head.
We obviously just had another Tarzan a couple months ago. What were your own thoughts on the new film and our new Tarzan?
I really liked it. I think sometimes for people who grow up on the books, when you see book brought to the screen, you have to shut the inner critic off. And I went into this knowing it's an original story. They've changed most of the plot elements of it, but it does incorporate the elements from the books. And I think they got the character right on. Of course, in the novels, Tarzan does marry Jane. They meet in the jungle. He goes away to England to be Lord Greystoke for about 10 years. And then in the novels, there were 24 original novels. By the third novel, he gets drawn back into the jungle. So it was a very similar setup to what happened with the movie, and sort of the reversion to the primitive and regaining who he was and who he was sort of denying that he was while he was in London.
I was looking at all the photos in the book, and I think Tarzan to me always feels like a great example of illustrating how we perceive stars, and specifically body image as well, because you look at the Johnny Weissmullers or the Lex Barkers of the 40s and the 50s, or you go even further back to the silent characters, you know, they weren't masculine, you know, cut He-Man like Alexander Skarsgård is in this new movie. Tarzan, a really great kind of time capsule of how Hollywood saw masculinity.
There have been books and articles written on this notion of the male body image and how Tarzan embodied that. Of course, Elmo Lincoln, the very first one, was a strong man. He had a 53-inch chest. He was huge and massive, and he conveyed this sort of sense of gravity and strength. People just weren't, back then, that was what was conceived as masculinity, as big and massive and muscular. And that evolved over time to the ultimate athlete would have been, you know, an Olympic medalist, or the ultimate man would have been an Olympic medalist because he would have been a world-class athlete. And then, you know, with Lex Barker, they got more into sort of an idealized matinee idol looking guy. You had Gordon Scott, who was a bodybuilder, Jock Mahoney, who was one of the preeminent stuntmen of Hollywood in his day, just a tremendous athlete. Mike Henry, who they sort of went the James Bond route, you know, in the 60s when the spy films were out, and he had the Brill creamed hair and the attaché case and the nice business suit, and sort of does like Alexander Skarsgård and reverts to the primitive, on up to the feral man of Greystoke, where Hugh Hudson went back to sort of these early accounts of people who had been raised by animals or allegedly raised by animals, and what that would be like with a person who was lean and wiry and dirty and fierce.
Looking at the Tarzan that we have now and the fact that it didn't do, you know, boffo box office on that budget, do you see Tarzan having a place in the film firmament in 2016 and into the future?
Tarzan will continue. I mean, he's gone on for 104 years now. I don't think he's going to stop now. And new fans are being generated all the time. This film really tapped on, you know, as I said, sort of a spirit of the times. And I think, too, that the filmmakers were very canny in that the film hits all the quadrants. There's nothing too objectionable violence for older children, say 10 or 11, who are going to this film and enjoying it. Women find it really appealing and really find Skarsgård appealing. I think that they did a really good job of broadening Tarzan's appeal and broadening the fan base, and that that's going to pay off in the future.
The last question I have is, do you have a favorite Tarzan or a favorite Tarzan film out of them all?
You know, that would be like picking a favorite child. I like them all, even the silly ones, even actually like the second cycle of Weissmuller films, where Saul Lesser took over and the budgets were lower, and they had the sort of fantastic themes like Amazons in the jungle and the leopard men who were stalking and killing people and the lost tribes and that sort of thing, because that sort of harkens back to Burroughs in spirit, at least. So, yeah, I have a fondness for all of them. There aren't any that I really dislike or hate. I can, like I said, divorce myself from the Tarzan of the novels, who's my true Tarzan, who was the character I grew up, you know, really enjoying and appreciating, and just enjoy the movies for what they are, you know, which is escapist entertainment.
Thank you so much for taking time out to chat with me about this. I had a lot of fun with the book, and I actually learned far more than I anticipated.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak.
I'd like to thank Peter Winkler and Scott Tracy Griffin again for coming on such short notice and helping to save this episode. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. It just helps the show. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com. You can also visit me at my official website, where I'm talking classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Next time, hopefully we will have a Ben-Hur episode. Rick Aragon will be back, and we'll be talking the 1959 Charlton Heston version and the 2016 version that just came out a couple weeks ago. Hopefully the gods will be kind, and that episode will be coming to you in 2 weeks. As always, I am your host, Kristen Lopez. Until next time.